Hey guys, welcome to Super Podcast. This is episode 56, I want to say. I'm your host, Super Marcy. And with me, as always, is my trusty co-host and terrible Australian, Bede. Hello, Bede.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
I was doing really well until I smacked my leg like 20 seconds ago.
I know, and I was laughing my ass off.
Yeah, and you're a bastard.
I take pleasure in your pain, Marcy.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Mm. So aside from that making you a freaking terrible person, what makes you specifically a terrible Australian this week?
Alrighty, I'm a terrible Australian because I have seen Confessions of a Shopaholic.
I can't say I've had any interest to ever watch that movie, ever.
Yes.
Mm. I don't even know what to say.
Well then.
Is it because deep down you thought that you were kind of girly and you wanted to watch a movie about shopping?
No comment.
Oh.
Can any film with Kristen Scott Thomas in it be entirely bad, though?
Yes.
Oh. Yes.
I like to think of Shopaholic as an experiment on PJ Hogan's behalf to see if he can make a movie worse than Muriel's Wedding. And he did it close. Yeah.
Muriel's Wedding rocks, man, and I will, like, send you a virtual punch later. Anyways.
With that said, we'll introduce our guests. So, yes, both returning to the show. Hopefully we won't have a 10-hour podcast, but we'll see. We have AJ. So, hello, AJ.
Hello, AJ.
Hello. How are you?
I am peachy. It is currently 5:58 in the morning here in Wisconsin in the frozen tundra of the United States. So I'm doing as best as I can.
Yeah, I don't envy you whatsoever. Just because, you know, we haven't really been having a summer, but seeing as you're freezing cold, I won't say anything.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, 30 below here on my way to work, 30 below.
That's crazy.
I know, that ain't shit for Wisconsin. That's nothing.
Wow, you should turn into a polar bear or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. Mm. All right, with that said. Sure.
But an awesome polar bear.
Yeah, I just mean, like, you might want to, you know, because they can survive the cold. That's what I meant. Anyway.
Move on.
Awkwardness aside, moving on. And we also have, all the way from England town is Sam Inglis. Hello, Sam.
Hey, Marcy. AJ. Hey, guys.
How are you?
I'm good. It's, I don't know, kind of a crap day aside, you know, given that it's Valentine's Day.
Yes, very anti-Valentine's Day on my
otherwise
end.
Otherwise good, thank you.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I'm single. What can you do?
Yes, I'm single as well. Now.
Sam will die alone.
You bastard.
Don't tell me that I will, because I will cry. Anyway. Shall we...
Anyway, that was fun.
Anyway.
Well, I'm single too, but I'm not going to say anything.
I'm not single. I have a girlfriend. This has never happened to me before.
I know. This is unbelievable. Congratulations,
you
know, AJ.
Girlfriends and boyfriends on this podcast. That's a rule, man.
Well, whatever. Should we get to our topic,
to
please?
Retire soon. Yeah.
All right, we'll get to our topic. This is Why Haven't You Seen These Movies, Part 2, Electric Bugalo? So basically, we just are going to be talking about movies that a lot of people haven't seen, and we kind of want more people to see these movies, basically.
Because they're awesome.
Exactly. So I might hand it over to Bede for his, like, maybe number 5 pick, which he'll be very brief on.
Why does it always have to be me, man?
It's not always you. You always go last. I'm picking on you today. Or tonight.
Fair
or whatever.
Enough.
Indeed, fine. Indeed, that's indeed, good. Bitch.
All right. My first pick, as why haven't you seen these movies, is the documentary Dear Zachary, A Letter to a Son About His Father.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, without a doubt, one of the most emotionally devastating and most powerful documentaries I have ever seen.
And would you care to tell me why?
That's just the thing, because this is one of those movies you really can't know too much about before you watch it.
Okay.
Because it kind of, because it's one of those things where you just, as a viewer, you watch it and you sort of find out what happens during the course of the movie, layer by layer. But yeah, because like any just inkling of what the movie's about, you can pretty much kind of figure out where it's going to go. So I'm not going to say like what it's about.
Okay.
All I can say is that it's an amazing documentary that actually made my number 6 film on my 2008 top 10 list.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just definitely worth checking out. It's all I can say is you will definitely be devastated by the end of this movie. It has that power.
Okay, well, I haven't seen this movie. Have our other two guests seen this movie?
Yeah, I have. And I've got to agree with Bede. It's a wonderful film. It's one I've actually thought about doing for this or for my written Why Haven't You Seen series. It was broadcast on the BBC's excellent Storyville series over here, and it just ripped my heart out. It's a great piece of work and well worth tracking down.
Cool. And AJ... Yep.
I haven't gotten to see it, but it is in my Netflix streaming queue, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. I've heard a lot of good things.
Awesome. There we have it.
I did send a copy of it to you a while ago.
Yes, I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yes.
But I will, I promise. I'll get to everything you've ever sent me.
Of course.
So, next person I'm going to hand it over to AJ.
All right, the one I'm going to start out with, because we were talking about earlier in the pre-show chat, I was under the impression that we were only going to do three picks, so I only have three prepared. But I'm going to start with the one that has the less chance of entertaining other people. It's more of worth for nostalgic value for me more than anything, and it's 1994's Radioland Murders, which was produced and conceived by George Lucas, weirdly enough, and rumor is like that was supposed to be one of his first post-Star Wars projects way back in the day before he became the money-hungry monolith he is today, but I digress. It's just pretty much an homage to like the 1930s slapstick comedies. Like, people talk really fast. Like, if anyone out there has seen Family Guy, you'll know what I mean when I say this is the epitome of fast talking high trousers. It's that kind of movie, and I'm just trying to find the words to describe it. Like, it puts more stock in the supporting people. It has all faces in the supporting cast. It has like George Burns right before he died. They got George Burns, Christopher Lloyd, Rosemary Clooney, and like Ned Beatty, Corbin Burnson, Brian James, just all these different people. And then who do they have right on the cover, like headlining the movie? Brian Benben and Mary Stuart Masterson. I know there was once upon a time Brian Benben could headline a movie, and it was a bomb. The plot's really a mess. The comedy's just really overdone, but I saw it at that impressionable time in my life when I was starting to become a movie fan, and it was just fun to watch. Like I describe it, Radioland Murders, as the comedy equivalent of Lady in the Water. I enjoy watching it, although the movie itself gives me no reason to do so.
Go on, sell it.
I've actually seen Ray.
I know, it's fun.
Yeah, I actually kind of enjoyed it. Like, I do agree, like, it is very flawed, and at times, like, the comedy seems very forced and whatnot, but there is some kind of sort of nostalgic feeling to it that kind of made it work somewhat for me. Like, I think it's because, you know, it is, what was it, the 1930s or 40s? I sort of can't remember.
Yeah, it was like in the late 30s, and like television hasn't dominated, and that's like the thing they like tack on at the very end, is that one of the guys like invented television, and they're like, no, radio will never die, the human imagination will always persist, and they just kind of tack that on at the end. But even though it's just so out of place, like they just didn't really build up to it, it's just kind of a nice little sentiment. It, as a whole, the movie is a bit of a wreck, but it has portions of it. There's like little things about it that I do really enjoy.
Cool. Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
No, so. I haven't seen it either. That's an interesting cast, and I've got to say, I'm rather fond of Mary Stuart Masterson. You know, I just find her kind of charming in a lot of stuff. So, you know, I'll look out for it.
Hmm.
I've always liked Mary Stuart Masterson, and I kind of wish she'd sort of, you know, get back in front of the camera these days.
Yeah, but, really?
Yeah.
Mm. Alrighty. Thanks for that one, AJ. Sam, how about your, say, number five pick?
Yeah, I'm going to start with a film that people probably haven't seen because they pretty much can't, which is Ken Russell's film The Devils.
I saw it.
You did? Excellent.
But you've seen
what I can promise you is that you almost certainly haven't seen the uncut version because it's pretty much never been released. It's a film about a priest played by Oliver Reed who is in a lot of ways very immoral, and he's placed on trial for heresy by a group of witch hunters who are sort of seeking to take over the town that he's the priest of. There's also the accusation that he is a witch who has possessed the Mother Superior at the local convent, played by Vanessa Redgrave, and thrown her and the entire convent into a sort of sexual frenzy. Incredible sequence that, where the witch hunters sort of try and discover whether Vanessa Redgrave and the nuns are possessed. It's really quite disturbing. But there are sequences that in 1971 the BBFC cut, notably what is referred to as the Rape of Christ sequence. You can see why it's controversial, which was thought to be lost for a long time. But the UK critic Mark Kermode, who is a huge Russell fan, actually spent years hunting it down, found the cut scenes, and he and Russell had them restored to the film. It was meant to be released on DVD, but Warner backed out. And there was no explanation ever given. And all I can think, really, is that they're just scared to release it, which is saying something 40 years after a film was made, that it's still so considered so powerful and so controversial in what it says about religion and the way it sort of can control the populace. That it's still considered so controversial that they literally won't release it. I'm hoping that for the 40th anniversary something will happen, even if it's just a Warner Archive disc, but I can't see it happening. But either way, it's a magnificent film in whatever form you can see it. Vanessa Redgrave and Oliver Reed are both brilliant, but what's really most interesting about it is Ken Russell's visuals. It's such a weirdly designed film in so many ways, particularly the convent, which has these sort of weirdly arched ceilings, which Vanessa Redgrave, who's a hunchback in the film, sort of hunches under, and it just the visual composition of it, it's just gorgeous. So that's Ken Russell's The Devils. Which if
I
you
have
can
actually
possibly
seen.
Find a copy, you really should see.
I have actually seen that one a long time ago, but I have seen it.
I've always known of it, but I still haven't seen it yet.
Nice pick. I guess we'll go to me.
Yes.
Now for my I saw this movie a couple of weeks ago and I thought, well, might as well include it. It's only recent, but I had heard a thing about it. I had no idea this movie even existed. It is called The Countess, which is a film by Julie Delpy, who wrote and starred in it. And it's about the Countess Elizabeth Bathory, who killed lots of virgins and soaked in their blood because she thought it would make her younger or keep her youthful.
Seems to be working for Julie Delpy.
It was a really interesting movie. I really liked it because I know a lot about the real story anyway. So I was quite surprised to see there was a movie about it, and even more surprised that it was Julie Delpy behind it. She's really, really good in the role. She kind of adds a lot of sympathy to the character, which shouldn't have any at all. And then they twisted in a bit of a romance in there as well. But I just thought it was a really, really surprising and good movie. The setting was great, the costumes were great, everything like that. It really looked historical. And it was definitely an interesting take on the character. It was actually a little more bloody than I was expecting, because I thought it starts off as like a period piece, and I didn't think they would go into a lot of horror aspects, but they did. So I found it quite interesting, and I definitely highly recommend it. I don't know if anybody else has seen it or even heard of it.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
I've known about it for a long time, actually, because it's been kind of kicking around and been delayed and all of that. And that's kind of why I've avoided it, because it's been very available online. But frankly, you know, the fact that nobody's picked it up, the fact that it's been delayed for so long, you know, didn't really bode very well to me. And I got to say, I didn't particularly like Julie Delpy's first directorial effort. 2 Days in Paris, which I think she's making a sequel to at the moment.
She is.
Yeah, not sold. Which is a shame because I love Julie Delpy. But I mean, at your recommendation, I'll certainly give it a crack.
AJ,
never heard of it. Sounds interesting enough, though. Julie Delpy, I'm game.
Yeah, it's definitely really, really different for her. I mean, as an actress, she did quite a good job as a director. I mean, some of the writing is a little bit lame, but then again, it is set many centuries ago. But I found it really, really interesting. You know, just because a movie kind of is in limbo with a release doesn't necessarily make it a bad film. So I would say keep that in mind. But yeah, I quite liked this one. So that's one of my picks. Now I'll send it off to Bead again.
All right.
Woo-hoo.
Okay. Woo. My next pick is the 2007 film The Nines, which is...
Oh, great pick.
Yeah. And it stars... it's another film just like Dear Zachary you can't really say too much about. But I'll give like a basic... small, kind of non-spoilery summary. It stars Ryan Reynolds, which could easily cut right away, Marcy, but anyways. He plays three characters in the movie. He sort of plays a trouble actor named Gary, who after sort of going around in a drunken sort of rage, he gets... goes under house arrest. And then there's another character that he plays who named Gavin, who happens to be a television writer who's trying to start up a television show for his childhood friend. And then there's a third story where he's a video game designer played Gabriel, whose car sort of breaks down in the middle of nowhere. And in a way, like, these are kind of at first you think these are just three separate stories, but just happen to have Ryan Reynolds playing all these three characters. But over the course of the movie, you sort of realize that these three characters are somehow linked to each other. And from there, you sort of discover that what comes after that during the course of the movie is really, really interesting and quite original. And again, you can't really say too much because it'll give away too much of the plot, but it's definitely a film I recommend highly anyone to go check out because it, like I said, it's completely original and it pretty much, you have no idea where the story's going to go. And mm-hmm. once you do, you're kind of like sitting there thinking, just wow, like where the story ends up. And like all the performances are great. Like there's sort of Hope Davis sort of pops in and out during the movie as a woman who in each of these three stories. And also the film was written and directed by John August, who has like written a lot of sort of Hollywood movies, kind of like he wrote Go, Charlie's Angels, a lot of Tim Burton stuff like Big Fish and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and whatnot. So this is like a very small scale, very original and quite a thought-provoking film that I definitely highly recommend everyone to check out. And also, of course, Ryan Reynolds gives a terrific performance as each of the three leads, I mean, the three characters in the film.
I've been curious about that one, but I haven't seen it.
Exactly. Yeah, I loved it. I love all three of the leading performances, Ryan Reynolds, Hope Davis, and Melissa McCarthy, who's just wonderful in it. And Elle Fanning as well, who's always so good. She pops up in one of the stories and is, you know, as effective as ever.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a terrific and really interesting and original piece of work. Yeah, great pick.
Yes. AJ, have any comment for that one?
I haven't seen it, but it's one that at the video store I work at, we have it, and I've picked it up a lot of times. I brought it home. I just have never gotten around to watch it, but it sounds like an interesting movie, so I'll have to keep that one in mind for next time I'm working there.
AJ, ready for your next pick.
All right, my next pick is a movie I actually just saw in the last couple of weeks, and I believe it's from 1991, and it's called Cast a Deadly Spell. And like Radioland Murders, this is another period piece. This one's set in the later 40s, and it's a private eye movie set in a world where pretty much everybody uses magic. Like, magic is real, monsters are real, vampires, werewolves, everything, they're all real. But Fred Ward plays H.P. Lovecraft as a detective, but he's the only one in Los Angeles who doesn't use magic. And David Warner plays like this, he's like the standard type. He's like he's the rich guy, and he hires Lovecraft to find this missing book. And it's another one, I don't want to say too much about it, since you do discover a lot about it as it goes along. But what I liked about this movie was that it found just the right tone. It's not overtly campy, and it's not too serious. It finds just the right way to deal with, like, the private eye cliches, and then it just kind of works in, like, those really fantastic, really out-there monster elements in there. And how they pull it off was really well. Like, there's a scene where Lovecraft is being tailed, but instead of, like, someone trying to poison his drink or whatever, they slip him some runes. Like, Night of the Demon, like, they just try and slip him the runes, so like, a demon will come out from hell and take him. So he just has to, there's this whole scene where he's trying to, like, pass him off back to somebody else, and it's just a really interesting idea. And, like, the story itself, you can kind of figure out, like, what's gonna happen, where the plot twists are gonna come, who's gonna betray. But it's very interesting to watch, not only just because of the story, but because done in 1991, you get to see a combination of people that you wouldn't necessarily see anymore, because this movie has, as I said, Fred Ward and David Warner, but it also has Clancy Brown from Highlander and Shawshank Redemption, who now does Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob, and it has Julianne Moore in it as the femme fatale.
Wow.
Like, she's Lovecraft's old girlfriend.
I mean, really, why haven't I seen this movie? I'm sitting there with my mouth open going, why the fuck haven't I seen this? It sounds amazing.
I am totally sold on this, by the way, even before you mentioned Julianne Moore being in it.
Yeah.
And the best part is...
I am totally fucking sold. Where can I get this?
And the best part, it was directed by Martin Campbell, Mr.
What?
Green Lantern. That's Martin Campbell. And not only that, he did a sequel to this. It was a made-for-HBO movie. And they did a sequel called Witch Hunt, which I haven't gotten to see yet. I'm trying to seek that one out. That one, it's Dennis Hopper, and it's Paul Schrader directing it.
Holy shit.
I have to see this. Fucking
I have to see this fucking movie.
Yeah, especially since on IMDb, apparently Witch Hunt, Dennis Hopper said that was the strangest movie he had ever been a part of. So whoa. I need to see this as well.
That has got to be amazing.
But yeah, it's a really cool, very fun, very entertaining, creative movie, if you can find it.
Definitely going to be looking for that one. So, Sam, give us your next one.
Yeah, well, I mean, talking of strange, Sion Sano's film Love Exposure. When I reviewed this, I referred to it on my blog as being as mad as a box of frogs on acid. It's completely and utterly insane. It's longer than Gone with the Wind. It's 237 minutes long. It's a romantic comedy, kind of, but it also involves such concepts as original sin, upskirt photography, martial arts, and terrorism.
Wow.
It's indescribably strange, and just... joyously offbeat. Every minute there's some twist or turn that you just are completely floored. The action is fucking fantastic. It's got a really balmy, off the wall sense of humor that I just totally plugged into. And I mean, yes, you have to give over an afternoon to watching it, but frankly, by the time that the opening title comes up, 58 minutes into the film,
fuck me,
you'll kind of have forgotten that you're going to give an afternoon over to it and just have been totally swept up in its utter insanity. I love the leading performances, but particularly Sakura Ando, who plays the leader of this sort of weird group who are tracking the main character for reasons that remain obscure until about 3 hours into the film.
Fuck.
I can't tell you how strange it is. I can't really explain it or sell it to you other than to say that it will be completely unlike anything else you've ever seen. And that, for me, in and of itself, is enough to make it an essential watch. I also saw Sano's next film, which is called Cold Fish. I saw that at the London Film Festival. That's also completely out of its mind and, completely off the wall and original. I think it marks this guy out as somebody who's really well worth watching for a truly original vision. So, yeah, Love Exposure, inexplicable, mad as a bicycle.
Sono and I are not on speaking terms. I sat through Noriko's dinner table and Suicide Club for that bastard. He can go jump off a cliff as far as I'm concerned.
You've got to check out Love Exposure. It's just so... I can't imagine you not liking it because you like the stuff that's so sort of offbeat and weird. It's just so strange.
I'll think about it. I'll put it under consideration.
At least give it until the opening title.
Yeah, give it about 50 minutes, AJ.
Yeah. Oh, just. I don't know. Isn't there a Cool as Ice director's cut out there I can watch instead?
Maybe, if you ask nicely. We'll move along to me. I've decided to go with another recent film. This one kind of really got me obsessed with one Michael J. White. And the movie is called Blood and Bone, and it is a martial arts movie. It was a low-budget direct-to-DVD martial arts movie. But this movie is absolutely phenomenal. It is, in my opinion, one of the best movies you'll find that went direct-to-DVD. It's one of the best martial arts movies you'll find within the last 10 years easily. It's got a really good storyline. It's got some, for the most part, really good acting. And I just loved it. That's all I can say. I loved it. I sat down and watched it. In the first 5 minutes, my mind was blown. There's this fantastic fight sequence at the beginning. It's basically about a guy who comes out of jail and he starts doing this underground fighting. And you find out why he does it and what's going on what's going on with it. There's also the bad guys as well. So obviously Michael J. White's the main good guy. You've got I can't pronounce his name. Amon Walker, who was in Oz as one of the bad guys, and Julian Sands as the top bad guy, but he really hands it up. And Dante Basco ends up being the
Rufio?
Yeah, Rufio. He ends up being the sidekick, and when I actually met him a few years ago at a convention, I said to Dante, I completely loved this movie, Blood and Bone. I said, I loved doing it. And he commented and said, yeah, this is like an amazing movie to work on. He loved the character he got, and he just thought it was such a great movie, and it was really cool to just have a little chat to him about it. But yeah, the martial arts in this movie are phenomenal. It's just so great. It's such a great, kind of action-y drama martial arts film. I can't recommend it enough. It packs a punch, I'll say that much. So yeah, definitely check out Blood and Bone for a really good martial arts fix. And cool. That's my pick. I don't think any of you have seen it, I'm guessing.
I haven't seen it yet.
No, I mean, my interest in martial arts films, you know, really lies in Hong Kong, China, Thailand, that sort of arena. I just find that kind of martial arts, you know, much more interesting on screen most of the time.
Mm. I mean, I'd really recommend this movie highly. If it weren't for Blood and Bone, I probably would not have checked out Undisputed 2 and Undisputed 3. Even though Undisputed 3 doesn't have Michael J. White, just that same kind of awesome martial arts behind it. So freaking good, and check it out.
My next pick, as anyone who knows me, I'm a huge fan of Australian movies. I will watch anything that is Australian. Especially in the last couple of years, but there's one film in particular that I thought I might talk about sort of briefly. Is a film that came out in 2007, again, because 2007 was an awesome year for movies, if I say so myself. But that movie, of course, is Romulus, My Father.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Australian drama that's sort of based on the autobiographical novel by Raymond Guider, who was like this sort of famous Australian professor and philosopher. And it's about his childhood growing up in the Australian outback with his immigrant parents, who were played by Eric Bana and Franca Potente. Mm-hmm. And the young Raymond in the film is played by a young actor who's sort of making a splash around the world at the moment, is Cody Smith McPhee, who was recently in films like the road and let me in. And this is like, and he is absolutely amazing in this film. I pretty much anytime someone sort of mentioned him being cast in a film, I would be like the full supporter of his, saying like, in my opinion, I think he's one of the most talented young actors working today. And if you watch Romulus, My Father, you can definitely see that, because this was actually his, I think this might have been his feature film debut. Like he did a lot of sort of television stuff, but this is like his first film role, and he is absolutely amazing. I mean, the fact that this kid blew Eric Banner off the screen is quite an achievement, and Eric Banner is quite amazing in the film as well. And the thing is, it's sort of about his childhood, again, in the outback. But the thing is, both of his parents are sort of separated. His mother sort of suffers from depression, and she keeps leaving at her own convenience and coming back at certain moments in his life. And as well as his dad sort of suffers from a bit of mental illness. And it's quite a really deeply affecting film. And and it's weird, though, because this film could have easily have been very sentimental, but the way that it's sort of directed and acted, it's not that at all. It's quite a moving film, but it doesn't fall to that sentimentality at all. And the film was directed by Australian actor Richard Roxburgh, who, if anyone who knows who he is, he's sort of been in a lot of sort of major blockbusters like Moulin Rouge, Van Helsing, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Mission Impossible 2, where he played
the guy that loses his pinky finger.
Little pinky finger, and he goes around saying like the most hilarious line in that movie. It was like, "Be careful, you don't know who you might run into." That's
that was a good South African accent, by the way.
Like, thank you. And he, this is his directorial debut, and it's a great, great debut. It's directed with so much subtlety, so much care, and it's just so beautifully handled. Like, it's not really a movie that kind of drives on plot. It really more drives on just pretty much these kind of small vignettes with that sort of captures, like, I sort of read this review a while ago, and I thought they pretty much summed up how the movie was somewhat structured. Is it's more of like sort of capturing Raymond's sort of, you know, child moments that stood out to him when he was a kid. So it's kind of like that, how it's structured. Like, even though it's linear, but it's sort of not really, like I said before, it's not really a plot-based film. But it is a really great film. And the film also stars Martin Kostkus. Again, another sort of New Zealand actor who, of course, has been in a lot of sort of major blockbusters like The Bourne Supremacy, Aeon Flux, and a bunch of other films. So everybody in this movie is directed. The acting is superb. It's, like I said, beautifully directed. It's beautifully well written. And it actually did make my top 10 films of 2007, where it made it at number 9. And it's definitely worth checking out. And if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's quite a beautiful film.
Yeah, I've seen bits of it. I haven't seen the whole thing, but I really wanted to watch it.
Yeah. And like I said, it's quite a moving film. And it really is, like, the performances, like I said, are all terrific. And Cody Smith-McPhee, after watching this film, like I said before, I knew for a fact that he was going to be, like, a major acting talent in the future.
Mm.
Yes.
Cool. AJ, would you like to go next?
Well, I don't know. I know you guys have more picks than I prepared, and I mine's a special one, so I might want to save mine towards one while you're getting to the end of yours, so I'll pass it off to Sam.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to talk about three French films next. I didn't plan that, but that's the way it's come out. First of all, Claude Chabrol's film La Cérémonie, which was, it's kind of late period Chabrol, made in 1995, with Sandrine Bonnaire and Isabelle Huppert in the lead roles. So, I mean, already the quality just kind of is piling up. It's based on a Ruth Rendell novel called A Judgment in Stone. And it's about a young woman played by Sandrine Bonnaire who gets taken on as a housekeeper to a wealthy family. And while she's there, she makes friends with the local postmistress, who has a sort of weirdly undefined feud going on with the family that Bonnaire works for, and obviously the postmistress played by Isabelle Huppert. And as the film goes on, their relationship becomes closer and closer and very subtly more and more sort of weirdly close and disturbing. And they each kind of seem to bring out the worst in each other. There are hints at things in each of their pasts that are quite disturbing and violent, but you don't know whether they're actually responsible for them. And it ends with this incredible act. I mean, I can't tell you about the ending because it's so shocking and sort of unexpected. And that's the main point of the film, is that it has to be this huge shock. But the performances are what really make the film for me, as you might expect. Bonnaire plays a woman who is kind of keeping a secret about her education. And she does that very subtly and very well. I mean, you can sort of see that she's hiding something, but still the actual resolution to it kind of comes as a bit of a surprise. And you can, but for me, the great performance in it is that of Isabelle Huppert, who's really different here. She's famous for being sort of very cold and very calculated in her roles. But as Jeanne, the postmistress, she's very sort of flighty and energetic, and you know, she's the sort of irresponsible one of her and Bonnaire's character, who sort of draws them both into what eventually happens. It's a really interestingly different performance and as good as ever from her. But I'm not going to give anything more about it away, because you really need to see it. I think it's one of Chabrol's best films, which, given that he made over 60 before he passed away last year, is saying a great deal. I think it's a piece of a great kind of Hitchcockian thriller from a great director who doesn't get his dues often enough.
Anyway, I'll go with my next pick, if that's all right with everybody. Yep. I've gone with a film that I saw recently as part of my Dissecting the Director series. And I discovered a movie called Survival Quest from 1989 from Don Coscarelli. I had never heard of it, had no idea what it was about. I went into it without any knowledge of what it was. I just had the title. Turns out I absolutely loved this movie. It's about two groups of people. The first group are like, they're called Survival Quest, and they're like, it's like a self-help group for people who just want to go out in the wild and learn to survive in the wild, basically. And they're led by Lance Hendrickson, which automatically means awesome. But at the same time, on this camping, like where they go out in the woods, the forest, whatever, I know what I mean, into the wild, that's better. There's another group of guys, and they're a paramilitary group. They know about each other going at the same spot. And this group is led by Mark Rolfson, who's really, really, really good as the leader of that group. And when the two groups kind of collide in a way and someone ends up dying, the paramilitary guys blame the other group, the Survival Quest group, and they decide they want to hunt them down So the survival group basically have to learn all their new skills in order to survive and get back. Basically, that's it in a nutshell. The movie looks great. It's got a great setting. I mean, you really wouldn't want to be in their situation, I guess. The easiest way to put it. The film has some early performances from, like, Catherine Keener and Dermot Mulroney, and I had no idea they were in this movie. So it was kind of a bit of a surprise. I was also surprised to see Lance Henriksen in it, because I had no idea he was in this movie. But it turns out it's really, really good. I mean, for the most part, it's got decent acting. It's got a really good script. And it's really, really well directed. It's quite different from anything that Coscarelli has done before. So definitely, if you can track this one down, to check it out. It's just a great little movie. And I doubt anyone else has seen it.
I never even heard of it until you sort of mentioned it to me the other day, Marcy.
Yep.
No, I'm afraid I haven't seen it, but anything with Catherine Keener has my attention.
Yeah, I mean, this is from 1989, so she's quite young. She's one of the better characters from the group. So, yeah, I mean, it's really, really, really good stuff.
Cool.
I remember hearing the title. I had never actually really known what the movie was about. I just kind of heard the title, and Coscarelli's been kind of inconsistent with me just in the Phantasm series, but if you recommend it, I'll give it a look.
Yeah, I mean, as far as Phantasm goes, I mean, I think we pretty much agreed on those movies when we were discussing it recently, I think through Twitter.
Mm.
So, I mean, I definitely think it's worth watching. I mean, I don't think you'll hate it anyway. I think you'll definitely get something out of it. It's a fun movie anyway. So yeah, definitely worth a look. So Bede, I think you're next.
Yes.
Number two.
Okay. All right. My next pick is another film that just also happens to come out of 2007. You can see there sort of seems to be a running theme going on here. And that film is Grace Is Gone, which is...
Yeah, I need to freaking see this movie.
Well, yep, people yep. need, okay. everybody needs
Wonderful
to see
Wonderful choice.
Movie. Yes. Everybody needs to see this movie because nobody has fucking seen it.
Apparently. Except for you and Sam, it seems.
Yeah, I know for a fact that this was one of Sam's like favourites from the same year as well.
And it made my top 10 for 2008. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, it's sort of about... I'm trying to... Where is it? Okay, here it is.
It's sort of about... Okay.
Yeah, well, I got the Wikipedia page up so I can just, you know, remember the plot. It's sort of a... It stars John Cusack, who plays a husband and wife. I mean, husband and wife.
Husband and wife.
That's a different movie.
Okay, well, that's a completely different movie altogether. Sorry about that. He plays a husband and father, as I was trying to say, who discovers that his wife, who is a soldier in the Iraq War, has been killed. And then after receiving the news, he... unable to try and figure out how he can tell his two young daughters that their mother has died. He instead decides to take his two daughters on a holiday to this sort of theme park that they have always pestered him about for a long time that they want to go to. So pretty much on this way, it's pretty much this journey about this man trying to struggle where would be the appropriate time to tell his daughters and the fact about... that just what happens, is he able to, now that his wife's gone, is he able to look after his daughters? It's pretty much like, is he able to be the father that they need him to be, but as well as him trying to deal with his own grief with the fact that his wife's dead. And it is quite a moving film. It's so beautifully written and acted. And... It's definitely one of the most definitely one of the best films to deal with the Iraq War, and even though there have been sort of mixed ones, like some have been good, some have not been so good, but this one for me personally is up there as one of the best because it doesn't actually deal with the actual war itself. It really deals with the outcome after, if a soldier dies in war, what happens to the family back home, and it's incredibly moving. the acting is so sublime. And John Cusack, this is without a doubt, like, even though he's given so many great performances in the past, this is definitely up there as one of the best of his career. Because the character he plays in this movie is nothing like any character he's ever played before. Even though he's, in the last sort of couple of years, he's sort of playing characters that are kind of sort of variations on himself. But this one is completely different. Like, he gets the mannerisms of this sort of shy, grief-stricken, and sort of not really, kind of keeps to himself person. And his daughters, who are both played by, I'm just getting the, Gracie Bodonatsky and Sheelan O'Keefe, they were also, for two young actresses, especially child actors, they were both amazing as well. And it's an incredibly beautiful film. It actually did win two awards at the Sundance Film Festival for Best Screenplay and as well as the Audience Award for Best Film. And another reason what I love about the film is the score. Now, you're probably wondering who actually did the score. Believe it or not, the score for the film was actually done by Clint Eastwood. Mm. Well, the thing is, like, the movie already had a different score. Like, it was, from what I've heard, it's a very sort of, the original score that was played at Sundance was very sort of very orchestra, very string heavy, and sort of very sort of somewhat sentimental. But after when Harvey Weinstein, when he bought the rights to the film and the distribution rights and whatnot, he actually, it was his idea to actually get rid of the original score of the film and get Clint Eastwood to do the score. And what you're left with is a score that it is sort of his trademark score, like he's been doing for the last couple of films, where it's this very sort of very simple, very subtle sort of piano tunes. And I think the score really adds so much to the film and adds so much to the emotion of what's happening on screen, because it doesn't feel... like, it stands out, but it doesn't feel intrusive at all. Like, it doesn't say, it pretty much doesn't say, cry, damn it, cry at this scene, or anything like that. It's very subtle, and it's very beautiful, and Grace has gone just a fantastic film that everyone should see. And I definitely still reckon that John Cusack should have got an Oscar nomination for this film, because he absolutely deserved it.
Well, I just want to endorse every word that Pete just said. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. Generally moving without being, sort of overtly sentimental. Beautifully performed, and I cannot believe that it's still awaiting a UK release.
That's kind of criminal.
Yeah, never been released over here, either on at the cinema or on DVD, and that to me is utterly inexplicable. Because Cool as Ice just came out on DVD. Fucking Cool as Ice is on DVD and this isn't.
Sounds criminal to me.
It is. It's very, very criminal.
I promise you I will check it out, Bede and Sam.
See, I said that movie to you a while ago.
I know, shut up, Bede. I have like 300 movies to watch, so shut up. I'll watch it.
Yes,
I'll get to it too. It's another one of those ones like The Nine where I've rented it a million times and I've just never gotten around to watching it. I'm an awful American.
You both are very, very terrible.
I know. He's an awful American. I'll be an awful Australian for this.
Yes. Like I said, it's one of those films that it got so overlooked because I remember at the time when Harvey Weinstein picked this movie up, he was definitely going to endorse John Cusack for an Oscar nomination because, he's Harvey Weinstein, he can do whatever the hell he wants. But unfortunately, he never did that at all. And pretty much the movie just got a very crappy release in the US, like very, very limited release. And it's such a shame because it's definitely a movie. I think if it got the attention that it deserved, it probably would have been a huge contender, like it would season all that. I do know it did get received two Golden Globe nominations for Clint Eastwood, who did the score, of course, and also the song that sort of plays over the film that Clint Eastwood actually wrote, and that is sung by...
So hang on, he gets score and song nominations, but nothing for John Cusack or for the older daughter, Shelan O'Keefe.
Yeah,
it's ludicrous.
I agree. But, yes. So right. definitely check out Grace Is Gone. It's it is a very sad film, but it's just so beautifully well done.
Alrighty. AJ, are you ready for yours?
All right, I believe I am, and I am going to go the most obscure of the evening so far. It is a 1988 movie called The Wizard of Speed and Time. Has anybody else heard of this movie?
I have not heard of it, but that title alone has me sold.
I've heard of it because you keep talking about it all the time.
It's a movie, and I'm about to blab on about it some more.
Of course.
It's kind of like backstory about this. There's a guy named Mike Jitlov who got in the sort of doing like and doing like these little stop motion short movies. He's done a little bit of effects work here and there. He did a couple of shorts for the Disney Channel way back in the day. And in the movie Ghost, actually, he's the one that sort of designed the evil spirits. Like, he's kind of responsible for that aspect of the special effects. But as the trailer for the movie says, The Wizard of Speed and Time is about the world's most unknown filmmaker. And it's a very exaggerated, very over-the-top and wacky sort of depiction of what Mike Jitlov went through when he was trying to break into the movie business. Because in the late 70s, I would say around 79 or so, he came out with a short movie called The Wizard of Speed and Time, where all it was just he kind of... It was just a short movie where he, like, picked up this girl and took her to the Hollywood to become a star, and then he just sang about the movie and how magical it is, and that was really cool. And apparently someone enjoyed that short well enough and appreciated his special effects work enough to sort of let him have free reign over this movie. And what you kind of get is it's a very offbeat kind of satire about the movie industry. And, like, the whole impetus behind it is that it's about, like, these two producers who find one of Jitlov's demo reels and have this kind of competition because one of the producers is a nice guy. He wants to see Mike succeed. And actually, he's played by the hero of the giant spider invasion, Mr. Waddle Man. He's the good producer in this movie, Bede.
Yes.
And, like, there's the other producer who, like, doesn't want any no names. He just hates anything independent who isn't already established. So they kind of have this contest to see if Mike can make this short movie for, like, this TV show they're going to make about movie special effects. And, like I said, the whole movie is just about him kind of trying to break into the movie business and running into all these different problems, like not being able to... It's about kind of like him trying to film the entire short guerrilla style because he's kind of being thwarted every turn just by like the system. There's this scene where he tries to go to like all the different guilds, like the set builders guild and the acting guild, because all he wants to do is like make the movie by himself, but no one will let him unless he's members of all these guilds and pays. And it's got a great sense of sentimentality to it. It's just, he's just the world's nicest guy. And you just want him to succeed the whole time. And just the fact that everything in the movie is a cartoon. Like, there's stereotypes everywhere. Like, at one point, the evil producer, who, like, hires these two thugs, and one of them is overtly Mexican, and the other is overtly Canadian. So you just get, like, a lot of A's and essay, like, just that the whole time. And it's just so exaggerated and so over the top. But it's got such a really nice spirit about it. And Mike Jitlov just obviously loves what he's doing, even though the process of movie making just frustrates him so much. But for him to go through all that and then come out with, like, this very well-meaning, very entertaining movie, it's very sweet. And unfortunately, he hasn't done much since then. It kind of sucks because I read a couple of his, like, the script ideas that he's come up with over the years that he just has never gotten the funding to do. And he's he's got a very creative mind, and hopefully he'll do something, because he hasn't done anything, I believe, since Wizard of Speed and Time. But it's just a cool little cult movie. If you can find it, it is worth seeking out. It's just such a fun flick.
Well, I'm sold.
Yeah, that sounds very cool.
Sam.
Off the room.
Hey?
Sorry?
Say that again. Yeah.
I just said, and a chilled silence fills the room.
Well, we're all a little baffled by what you've just described, I think.
Well, yeah.
And we definitely all want to check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yes.
Anyway.
Sam's turn.
Marcy. Oh, Sam, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Anna M., which is a French film that I wrote about on my top 100 recently, starring the brilliant actress Isabelle Carré. Basically, she plays the title character, this young woman, Anna, who gets hit by a car at the beginning of the film, and then immediately and irrevocably falls in love with her married doctor. And it becomes a story about her erotomania towards him, her just total obsession with this guy, which isn't reciprocated. He's married to another woman played by Anne Consigny. And it's a really intricate exploration of this one character of Anna, and beautifully written by its director, Michel Spinoza, who apparently did a lot of research on real cases of erotomania for the film, and brilliantly played as ever by Isabelle Carré, who's just... She does some really messed up things in this film, like getting a job babysitting the kids who live above a doctor, so that she can be, you know, in the same place as him and eventually get into his apartment. And that's, you know, not the most of what she does, but you still feel for her because Carré plays her with so little judgment of her, first of all, and also with such sadness attached to what she's going through. Because, you know, as much as you feel sorry for Gilbert Melky as the doctor and for Anne Consigny as his wife, having to go through all this, it is also evident from Isabelle Carré's performance that this is a very sick woman, not an evil woman. And you end up for her. And that's the great skill of the performance, though it's also very, very disturbing. It's a wonderful, again, low-key little thriller. Very well done character piece as well, and yeah, the sort of thing that really only gets made in France these days, you know, a very quiet film, whereas in America it would have to turn into single white female at the end. This film never does. It's always about the psychology and the drive behind this character, not, you know, somebody going mental with a gun towards the end of the movie. And that, for me, is so much more interesting.
But
yes, has anyone else seen Anna M?
No, I have not.
No, but it sounds really interesting, to be honest.
It's a terrific film and an even better performance. Isabelle Carré is one of those people who, whenever she pops up in a movie, you can pretty much go and see it assured that there's going to be something worth watching. And this is no exception.
Interesting. Is it my turn?
Of course.
All right. My pick is Super Horny O Brothers 2. No, not really. I haven't actually watched Super Hornio Brothers 2. So...
Oh, surfing porn again.
No.
So is that like the Troll 2 of pornos?
Yeah, I reckon it might actually be the Troll 2 of porno. But no, that's not the real movie. The movie I was going to pick is Boy A from 2007, starring Andrew Garfield, which I saw recently. I think Bede mentioned it to me.
Yeah, based on my recommendation.
But it had Andrew Garfield in it, so I was going to watch it anyway. It's about, it's the story of, I think he's what, 18-year-old guy who's released from, I guess you would say jail in a way, because as a child he murdered another kid with somebody else. And this is the story of him trying to get back into society, but he can't tell anybody who he is. He has to start a whole new life because they don't think that he'll be able to have any kind of chance living in the society if people knew who he actually was because of the crime he was accused of doing. So the film doesn't really... it kind of tells you what led to the crime. It doesn't show you a whole lot. This is more about... you know, if this guy deserves to be out of prison and to start a new life, and how the media can pretty much just ruin everything for a person. The film is absolutely phenomenal, and Andrew Garfield gives this just unbelievable performance. The by the end of this film, I was floored. I was crying. I was so just, it was depressing. It really was. And the character he plays is somebody you really feel sympathy for. It kind of leaves certain things, for you to decide. This is definitely a movie that I think everybody should see. I don't really even know what to say about it. It's just such a phenomenal film, and I'm glad I've seen it, and I really just want other people to see it and give them something to think about.
I agree.
We've lost AJ again, but here he is.
That's
okay. It's not your fault. And I know Bede's seen the movie. Did you want to add anything to my ramblings?
I have to agree with Mark Mussey about Andrew Garfield. He was absolutely amazing in the film. And, like, I actually saw this because I had seen Andrew Garfield in, of course, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and I thought, yeah, he's really good at that, you know. Kind of annoying, but...
Yeah, he was annoying. I think that was the problem, is the character was kind of annoying in that, and this is where I kind of built up this strange thing of Andrew Garfield until I actually saw him in other movies.
Yeah.
Where he completely won me over.
I actually saw this film before I actually saw, you know, the doubleheader that was The Social Network and Never Let Me Go.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first watched Boy A, I just thought, holy shit, this guy, he's real acting talent. Like, he could have, like, and of course after that, you know, of course seeing him with two completely different performances in The Social Network and Never Let Me Go. The thing is, what I love about Andrew Garfield as an actor, in both Boy A and also, you know, the other films that I've seen him in, he brings an innocence to his roles.
Yeah, there was like a definite innocence to his character. But you're always unsure of whether he actually did what he did or if he was forced to do what he did, because you find out that it was him and another boy. So the title of the film is Boy A, because in court that's what they referred to him as, and the other boy was Boy B. So that's where that title comes from.
But what I loved about the film, though, is that when it starts off during the film, you're introduced to him. The very first scene, I think, there's so many great scenes in the film, but what I really loved was the first scene where he's about to get out of jail, and I guess... The man who's looking after him, who's played also amazingly by Peter Mullen, he sort of like starts giving him like some gear, you know, like clothes and all that. Mm. And there's this one scene where he's given like a pair of shoes.
Mm.
And he like, you just feel so much for his character because this is like the kindest thing somebody's ever given to him. Like he's never actually, yeah. since he's been in jail for practically most of his life up to that point, he doesn't, when he receives some of these sort of these clothes, he's like just completely moved by receiving them.
Mm.
And especially the shoes, because that the way he just how he looked at the shoes, it was just what really sold me on his performance. He could have, but there were so many great scenes after that. Actually, there what when I was sort of watching the movie, there was sort of another film that this film kind of reminded me of. And that was The Woodsman, which Kevin Bacon mm-hmm. starred in, which actually yeah. kind of reminded me a lot, like just for the tone and everything. But I think as much as like that film was great as well, and this one is great too, but I think a film like this, they make sort of his character very, very sympathetic. And I
mm-hmm.
really appreciate that. And I like the fact that they set up the character during the first half, and sort of little by little, you know he did a crime, but you're not even sure exactly what it is until during the course of the film as it's sort of revealed. And once you sort of know what he may or may not have been involved in, it sort of makes you think whether or not you should be feeling sympathy for this character. But at the same time, you do, especially during the course of the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder whether or not somebody can be rehabilitated, if somebody deserves a second chance, you know, whether or not, you know, even if he did what he did. And it's a very conflicting film. But, you know, the way he played this character, I kind of just wanted to, you know, grab a blanket and just cover him in it and just, you know, put him away in the corner sort of thing.
And just like, say, it's okay.
You know, it's okay. I'm going to shield you from the awfulness that there is. Have either of you other two seen this movie?
I'm afraid I haven't yet. I know I really should. It actually wasn't a cinema release here. It was a TV drama for Channel 4. I think that's kind of why I didn't watch it, because I generally think that British TV drama, British TV, is shit now, to not put too fine a point on it. I don't remember the last decent thing I saw on British telly, really.
Well, he was also in the other thing. I think it was on TV there, which was the Red Riding trilogy.
Yeah, and that I certainly count in that, because that's how I first saw Andrew Garfield, and I thought he was just terrible in Red Riding. There was no emotion or anything in that for me. I thought that was one of the most overrated things I'd seen in ages. So that's kind of why I got wary, because all I'd seen him into that point when Boy A was on was Red Riding, which I was massively disappointed in, and Lions for Lambs, which I also thought he was, you know, terrible in. But I've heard a lot of good things about Boy A, so I do have to check it out at some point. But I mean, that's why I haven't got around to it.
No.
That's another one that I've always like. I've always seen the cover, and I remember reading the back of it, but it kind of seemed to strike me as like a very vague description. I had no idea what the movie was about, or even that Andrew Garfield was in it. But now that he's kind of making a name for himself, and now that I actually know a little bit more about the story, it sounds pretty good, and I'll have to check that out. I'll rent it with the nines.
The story to me seems a lot like the real story of the two kids who murdered James Bulger.
Mm-hmm. As well. I think that's what
the movie was like somewhat based on.
Well, it was a novel. I think maybe that's what the novel could have been based around, because when I first went to watch it, that's immediately what came to mind.
Me too. Yeah.
And obviously that's kind of a raw thing for movie fans of my generation.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're of the same age as those kids who killed Bulger, and obviously as movie fans, it had a huge effect on us in the 90s over here, that crime. So there's some interesting stuff to be explored with that crime, though, I think. So I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, like I said, it makes you feel very conflicted over everything. But now I'll bring it back to Bede for his last pick.
Yeah, it sort of took me a little while because I actually sort of struggled to figure out what my last movie would be. And I'm actually sort of choosing between one now. But I think I might go with one. I might actually give a little honorable mention, just a small one, to the 2006 film Bobby, which was directed by Emilio Estevez and has like a massive, massive cast. And that movie sort of at the time when it got released, it sort of like got dismissed by a lot of people, say, oh, it was Oscar bait and, you know, and shit like that. But after when I sort of watched the film, I was completely and utterly moved by the film, but also the expert craftsmanship of what Emilio brought to the film, because he also wrote the script as well, and you can definitely feel his passion all over this film. It's a multiple character drama with a huge cast, like huge names. I mean, you've got Anthony Hopkins, Martin Sheen, Ashton Kutcher, Shia LaBeouf, Heather Graham, Sharon Stone, Demi Moore, and of course, the love of my life, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. So that one gets kudos from me, and that actually made my top 10 of 2006, so that one definitely worth checking out. But the movie I do want to talk about, and of course, Lindsay Lohan before, you know, she went crazy. Yes. That was like when she had like potential with that in both A Prairie Home Companion and Mean Girls, and after that,
it's definitely one of the films I mention when people say, oh, she's, you know, she's useless, she's got no talent. It's like, well, see Bobby, you know, see Mean Girls, Prairie Home Companion.
I agree. I absolutely love Bobby, and I think it sort of captures the time and the place of where, because it tackles the day of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. It's sort of like the build up to that, where you sort of introduced to all these many different characters. But what I love about the movie is, just quickly, again, it's sort of like, you can definitely see, like, this is like the, you can sense in all these characters that there's a hope, like, you know, the Vietnam War is going on, and they all believe that once Robert F. Kennedy becomes president, he will stop the Vietnam War, and everyone's hopeful of that. And then you can see the devastation that leaves them once after he is assassinated, and all their hopes and dreams were completely, utterly destroyed. So it's a really, really great film, and a very underrated film that everyone should check out. So that's my honorable mention. And of course, my last movie, and I thought I'd talk about this one because this is a movie I don't think anyone ever really talks about. It's a film from 2000. It's called Everything Put Together. Has anyone seen this movie?
Mm-mm.
I've heard the title. I've never seen it.
It stars Radha Mitchell. This is like when she was sort of getting into the sort of when starting out in the US. And the film is actually the directorial debut of Mark Forster, who, of course, after this would make a lot of sort of very degrees of different films, like from Monsters Ball to The Kite Runner to Stranger Than Fiction and Quantum of Solace and whatnot. But this is his debut film, and it sort of tells the story of a sort of a housewife by the name of Andrew, who's played amazingly by Radha Mitchell. And she sort of lives in this sort of suburban life of her husband, and everything's sort of picture perfect, as you can sort of picture the perfect suburban life would be, you know, the perfect house, the perfect neighbors, just everything's perfect, and she's pregnant. But once she gives birth to a baby, her baby dies. And after that, it sort of sends her on this sort of downward spiral that really affects her both emotionally and psychologically. And she sort of then all of her sort of neighbors, the ones who have always been there for her, sort of keep their distance from her as she's going through this. And it sort of just watches her, just her descent into this kind of madness. And at times, it's very chilling. And at times you really feel so much sympathy for her of what she's going through, but nobody can help her. And it's so, it's a very raw film. It's actually, it was shot on digital film. And it also in some ways is kind of a look at suburban life, kind of the dark side of the suburban life. And it's quite a while since I've seen the movie. So I'm kind of a bit fuzzy on the details, but I was completely, utterly, really just felt so punched in the gut by this movie. And I think it really did have to do with Rada Mitchell, who, like I said before, she was absolutely amazing in the film. And I always consider Rada Mitchell like one of the most underrated actresses out there, because even though she sort of like has been doing like sort of mainstream films and a lot of sort of horror movies, like, you know, Silent Hill and The Crazies and whatnot. But when she's sort of given a really juicy role, especially something like this, she is utterly amazing. And it's not a perfect film. Like, it is flawed in some ways, but I definitely just felt so captivated by this film and very disturbed and very moved at the same time. And, yeah, it's definitely a film that's worth checking out if you haven't seen it.
Interesting.
And of course,
yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it, but I really like Rada Mitchell, actually. She's got a couple of other Why Haven't You Seen movies out there. I would say High Art is definitely one. As AJ just mentioned on the chat here, Melinda. And yeah, I really like her, but I've got to say I find Mark Forster much more missed than hit as a director, personally. So that's maybe why I'm sure I've stumbled across this and gone, oh, Mark Forster, not sure.
Well, it's quite a bit. Yeah. It's quite a bit. Like I said, what I like about Mark Forster as a director, from the films that I have seen, is that he's very diverse. Like, you wouldn't think, like, you know, like I said, the movies that I read out before, like this film, as well as Monsters Ball, Stay, Finding Neverland, Stranger Than Fiction, Kite Runner, and Quantum of Solace. Even though, like you say, Seb, like, I agree, some of those movies, sort of his films are a bit of hit and miss, but he's...
Well, I was going to say the only one I liked was Stranger Than Fiction.
Well, I like Stranger Than Fiction as well, but I'm quite a huge fan of Finding Neverland and I really liked Monsters Ball as well. But when you sort of see his films, he's very diverse in his films, and you wouldn't think it's the same guy who directed all these films, because he adds his own different style to each film. But I think this is definitely up there as one of his best, especially, and it's a great debut from him, and it's definitely worth checking out. But I also give another little shout out to another sort of Rada Mitchell movie I guess a lot of people haven't seen, is Mozart and the Whale, which was one I was debating about which would be my final one. It's sort of she and it's a movie about, it's a romantic comedy drama that stars her and Josh Hartnett as two people who happen to have Asperger's syndrome. And it actually is, actually, again, it's both funny and quite moving as well, because, and I could relate to some of that as well, because it actually got to me on a personal level. So, and she's also amazing in that film as well. So definitely worth checking
Never
out.
Never even heard of that.
Yeah, it sort of got a very, very, very limited release. So I only just have even heard of it when it sort of came on TV one day, and I thought, oh, the premise sounds really interesting. And I watched it, and I actually really enjoyed it. So that's definitely worth checking out. But everything put together, like, watch this film, and you can definitely see just the talent that Rada Mitchell has as an actress. She is amazing.
Interesting.
Yes.
AJ, to you.
Yo,
no, mate, it's your turn for your last pick.
Oh, that was my last pick. Wizard was my last pick.
Oh, okay. So nothing else then? Because you only had three picked out.
Probably just some quick recent ones that I saw were really good. Electric Dreams was really good. Virginia Madsen movie from the mid-80s, actually. It's been released in on DVD, right, Sam, to the best of your knowledge?
Actually, Actually, I'll tell you this, AJ. I actually saw that movie a few months ago, AJ.
What'd you think?
So I didn't mind it. Like, it's quite a strange film, mm-hmm. but there yeah. are a lot of aspects. There were a lot of aspects that I actually did like. I love the soundtrack to that movie. It's amazing.
Is it kind of a Weird Science sort of thing with
Virginia
Madsen?
Continue. Yeah, it's one of those movies that it could only come from the 80s because it takes place during that time where, like, computers were just starting to take off. And, like, you had movies like Tron that were coming out where, like, computers could do all these weird things that we, like, nowadays we use to play, like, fucking Free Cell or Spider Solitaire on. But, like, just the whole object of... the whole premise of the movie is that this guy buys a computer and he like spills some like champagne in it. That's not it. It just becomes sentient. The computer becomes sentient, and there's like a romantic triangle between him, Virginia Madsen.
That's not romantic. That's disturbing.
But that's the magic of the movie. It pulls it off. Oh, and the computer has the voice of Bud Cort.
That's not romantic. That's disturbing.
No, if you watch the movie, and it actually is really charming. There's this really cool scene. I think I posted it on Facebook a lot, where because Virginia Madsen's character is this musician, and she plays the cello, and she's kind of up in her apartment, kind of practicing, and through the vent, the computer hears her and kind of does an electronic accompaniment to her music, and it's a really cool scene. It is very strange, and I can definitely see how you would look at the premise and just be like, the fuck is this? But it pulls it off. It's an odd movie, but it's very endearing. It's very sweet.
I have to sign it. Like, I'd have to agree in some ways. Because, like I said, it's a very odd movie. But at the same time, there's a bit of charm to it. And there's actually a great scene in the movie where a computer has a dream. Or at least what he thinks a dream would look like. And it's sort of done to a song by Culture Club, and I actually really, really love that scene and the song that accompanies it. And I sort of looked at who directed it. It's Steve Barron, and I thought the guy's name sounded familiar, and I wasn't sure where it was. And then I went on Wikipedia, and I found out that Steve Barron, after this film, would direct the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie.
I know, it's awesome!
Yeah,
he's got a weird career.
And I'm looking at it now. He also directed Coneheads, which is and The right. Adventures of Pinocchio, starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Jesus.
Yeah, so he's got a very, very, very weird sort of track record when it comes to his movies. So yeah, I actually didn't mind it. Like I said, it's definitely kind of a movie I can definitely see somebody really hating, but what really won me over was the performances, and Virginia Madsen was illuminating in the film. Like, I just thought...
She was freaking adorable. She was personified.
I wanted to, like, date her in the movie. And also, like I said, the soundtrack is also fantastic as well. Like, all the songs are amazing. I love it.
Cool.
Yes.
Cool.
Cool. All right, Sam, do you
want to
do your last one?
Yeah, this is perhaps a little more upmarket than Electric Dreams, but I was telling you about a very long film earlier. Well, that was nothing. Now I'm going to talk about Jacques Rivette's 5.5-hour, 2-part film, Jeanne La Pucelle, Joan the Maid. Which is about Joan of Arc, obviously.
Oh.
And I'm fascinated by Joan of Arc, actually. I think she's a really interesting character in history, and I've seen several films about her now. Obviously, the silent film, The Passion of Joan of Arc. Robert's wonderful one-hour film, The Trial of Joan of Arc, and both of those focus entirely on her trial, which is just about the only thing that Rivette leaves out of his film. There's basically a title card at a certain point in part two, which may as well just say, go and watch either the Bresson or the Dreyer. Yeah, because it just completely leaves out the trial, because there have been two great films about that in the past, so why bother? But what it does in great detail is explores kind of the last 2 years of Joan's life, when from just before she kind of joins the French army to her execution at the end. And the first half of the film is called Part One, The Battle, and kind of follows her up to a key battle. And the second part is called The Prisons, and follows her from her initial imprisonment, which seems to be have been in a stately home rather than an actual prison to begin with. She's kind of held prisoner in a very friendly way to begin with. and then she's obviously taken to her trial and to her execution. Joan is played by Sandrine Bonnaire, who obviously I mentioned earlier in La Cérémonie. And she's just a brilliant actress. She's probably a bit old in this film to be playing Joan, but you forget about that very, very quickly, and, because the force of her performance is such, and that you really believe that this 17-year-old girl can lead an army, and that people will follow. There's, you know, such force to her and such confidence about her. And it's a very interesting film formally as well, because Rivette, though the first film is called The Battles, there's actually precious little action. He doesn't do that very much. What he's more interested in is Joan the person and how she relates to the other people that she's leading. And he does that quite often with a very sort of documentary style, even having characters do sort of two-camera interviews in character, talking about, clearly from a couple of years after her execution, what Joan was like, what the experience was, and in these long sort of static takes. It's an interesting idea, because it brings very modern techniques to what is otherwise a very, you know, obviously medieval story, and very convincingly so. The few battle scenes are very, very good, but really, for me, the film is all about Sandrine Bonnaire's just incredible intensity of performance, and just the moving conviction that she brings to it. So I don't know if anyone else has seen this, no, or any part of it. I know it's a big investment of time.
No, but like you, I'm interested in Joan of Arc, so that would definitely be something I'd want to check out, I would say.
Sam, it sounds interesting, but is it better than Luc Besson's The Messenger?
I haven't actually seen that one. It's one of the few films about her that I haven't seen, but
I would bet yes.
Just on the fact that it has Sandrine Bonnaire rather than Mila Jovovich, and that's definitely a trade up.
But it has Faye Dunaway as well.
Yeah, again. I mean, as much as I love Bonnie and Clyde, Faye Dunaway is a serial scenery chomper, and there's none of that going on in Jean-Luc Housel. It's a very quiet, very subtle film, very slow at times. I mean, obviously it's 5.5 hours long, you know, so you definitely want to be in the right mood to sort of sit down and give yourself over to it. It demands some patience and some investment. But I think if you decide to give it that, it's a very rewarding piece of work, and a very high quality one from Rivette.
Would you say that this is like the definitive Joan of Arc movie?
No, I don't think there is such a thing. For me, I think what would be the definitive Joan of Arc movie would be if you kind of spliced Bresson's trial of Joan of Arc into the middle of this one.
Ah.
You know, because obviously it doesn't do the trial. Whereas I think the best film about the trial, and this is very controversial because I know everyone holds The Passion of Joan of Arc in very high regard, is Bresson's Trial of Joan of Arc, which is entirely drawn, both dialogue and action, from the actual trial transcripts, which incredibly have actually survived. So, yeah, I mean, it's close to being definitive, but by not doing the trial for whatever, however good a reason, it's probably not quite the definitive film.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I don't know if I want to see it if they've done it the way he's gone, is it?
Well, that would be your loss.
I have that video. What about you? Or didn't you? No, I'm kidding. I'll definitely check it out. But like you say, it's like at 5.5 hours, it would be like a massive investment to watch that.
It is in two parts, though. So it does... They're quite arbitrarily divided, it's got to be said. I mean, it's clearly one film in two very arbitrary parts.
Yep.
But you can sort of split it up in that way.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now on to me for my last pick. And I'm going with a movie which I, again, discovered recently. Again, I discovered it through the director's series. The movie that I've picked is called Furia, which is Alexandra Aja's debut feature-length film. It's a French movie. I'd not really heard of this movie before. It's based on a story called Graffiti by, I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name properly, but Julio Cortázar. So I wasn't really sure what to expect, considering all I knew of Aja was his horror movies. And this is kind of a little bit horror, but it's also a sci-fi, a bit of action, drama, romance. It's got all different things incorporated into the movie. And it's set in the future. And it's got like a very repressed government, and they have like these restrictions on the people. But the one that this movie chooses to, go into is that the government doesn't want them to have any kind of artistic expression. So drawing or painting, all of that stuff in that way is outlawed. But the main character, Theo, played by Stanislas Meher, I'll probably say that wrong. He sneaks out at night, risking, his life basically, because, you know, if you break the law, there's severe consequences. And he, like, does his artwork on the walls in the places where they live, and by day they get painted over. And during this time, he meets a really beautiful woman called Elia, who's played by Marion Cotillard. I think this is one of her earlier roles. And they form this romance, but she too does her art on the streets at night, and she gets caught. There's a lot more that's going on there, because one of the officers is Theo's brother, Lawrence. And there's this very complex, like, family dynamic that's going on, as well as this love story, as well as this, you know, very strange, repressed society. And then there's the artwork and what it represents to have this freedom of expression. It is a very visual film. Aja really, like, tells this story visually. Because as the way I watched it, I did not have the best subtitles, but I understood the movie pretty perfectly as to what was going on, what was being said, because visually you could just see it all. It just made sense. And the performances were just absolutely top-notch. And definitely a standout was Marion Cotillard. She's beautiful. She's got this really strange but hypnotizing character. And everybody else was quite good. I mean, this is a really well, written and directed film. I was really impressed with seeing this. I mean, especially as a debut film from somebody who was 20 years old when they made this. I mean, I can't imagine doing anything close to this when I was 20. It's intelligent. I definitely recommend this to anybody. It's worth a look, and I really think that, you know, people will get a lot out of the movie. I can't imagine anybody else aside from myself has seen it out of you lot.
I haven't. I'd really, really like to, having heard you talk about it. And I don't know, Alexander Aja's career just makes me sad. It really does. It's one of the most depressing careers I've ever seen, you know, watching him go from, you know, this and from Switchblade Romance, which was so astonishing, to these endless shitty remakes. It's depressing. I hope it doesn't happen to Pascal Laugier. But yeah, I'd love to see this. It sounds great.
I love his movies. I'm a big fan of his work. I mean, I really hated Mirrors, but that's, you know, another rant. I mean, I thought Piranha was like a fun movie, and it's kind of like sometimes you're just in the mood for that kind of film. But I really would like to see him go back to this kind of thing, with something very different and unique, and, you know, it's just so visually beautiful. I mean,
in all honesty, I think he needs to leave the States. I think he left his talent and his fucking artistic integrity back in France, and he needs to go back and pick it up.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if he kind of goes out of the horror genre and goes back to something like this, you know, I think it would be phenomenal. But if you can find it, definitely check it out. For some reason, I think it's widely available in, like, Mexico, but not so much anywhere else, apparently, from what I understand. You can find it on Amazon, but I think it's about $20-$30 US. Which is a little bit pricey for a DVD, but well worth it if you can find it. So that's that movie. And yeah, I think that's a wrap for our show. Something that I think we totally need to do on this show is let the listeners know where they can find us. So I can be found on the website at supermarcy.com. I can be found on Twitter at Supermarcy. We can be found on Facebook under Super Podcast, and you can email me at marcy@supermarcy.com. So we'll go around and everybody else can give their details. So, Bede, where can people find you?
You can find me on the corner of some street, you know, trying to get business. Sorry.
Yes, with your failed prostitution business.
Is that an unsubstantial?
It's actually been picking up quite well lately.
Yeah, Dreamer.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Okay, but seriously, though, you can find me, of course, at supermarcy.com, where every week you can see my my movie song of the week, which once a week I choose a personal favorite song from a movie and put it on the site. And at the moment, I'm doing the Oscar edition, so I'm putting up all the, for the next few weeks, I'll be putting up all of the songs that are up for Best Original Song at this year's Oscars. And also you can find me at, of course, facebook.com/BeJermaine, and as well as my Twitter at twitter.com/BeJermaine, or my Movie Fan Central page at moviefancentral.com/TerraAustralis. So, yeah. So, and, of course, you can hear my weekly recommendations on now on supermarcy.com's recommendations of the week.
Yes, our new feature, which started last week and will be continuing on. AJ, do you want to give us your details, please?
Sure, you can find me at www.spankme.com.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I have a lifelong subscription.
Exactly, part of the premium club. Now you can find me at bitching and moaning about movies on my Twitter account, twitter.com/madmovieman, And if you want to shoot me a message on Facebook, just look up AJ Hockery. I'm there. And if you want to email me and tell me how much of an idiot I am, my email address is ajhockery@hotmail.com.
Which I will do after this show.
I think we're all going to do that after this show now.
And Sam, give us your details, please.
Yeah, you can find my website, my personal site, at 24fps.org.uk for reviews and general sniping about movies. You can also find my stuff. I am film editor at multimediamouth.com, where I do a written series on Mondays. I promise the new one is coming soon, called Why Haven't You Seen, actually. And I also run the film section there and write occasional reviews. You can hear my dulcet tones on Super Podcast and hopefully soon on podcasts at Multimedia Mouth. You can find me on Twitter at 24FPSUK. And you can email me at sam@24fps.org.uk. That enough?
Yes, that is enough. I can't believe until now I keep forgetting to include this. So there you go. That's how you can find us. So for all of us on the podcast, I thank the listeners and I thank everybody for joining us. And until next time, I've been Super and everybody has been a snob. So good night and good luck.
And I've been terrible.
Indeed.
I've been off.
Okay. I've been English.
Yes. Pretty much. Indeed. So catch you later.
See you, everyone.